You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Philip Galanis is not writing his popular New York Times advice column, Social Cues, he works as a private practice entertainment lawyer, and he's also published two novels. Now he's come out with a book based on his column called Social Cues, How to Survive the Quirks, Quandaries, and Quagmires of Today. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings Philip Galanis to our show. Welcome.
Thank you, Leonard.
And we'll also be taking your calls. If you have a question about how to deal with an awkward social situation, give us a call at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And Philip, you'll be happy to hear we've been getting some really interesting ones already in expectation of your visit. So I don't know, you're going to have to do instant column maybe later.
I love that. Although I'll tell you, the one thing about this advice column business, Leonard, is you really don't have to try very hard to come up with really interesting questions. People have very interesting things that they need to get off their chests.
But I always find it interesting that they're willing to write to a newspaper to do it.
Well, it is.
There are certain questions that I have to resolve in my life, but I can't imagine, even if I thought you were the most brilliant person, I can't imagine sending
it
to you.
Wait, you said even if. That suggests that you think that maybe I'm not? Or let's get off on the right foot here. Please.
I think you're quite brilliant, Philip.
Okay, thank you. And I think you're even more brilliant.
Okay, well, we've started off
now we love
being
each other.
Social cues. In this past Sunday's column, you explained how you came to write the column. Are people still asking you why you?
People do ask why me a lot, because I'm not I'm not an Emily Post kind of person. I stumble into any situation that can be stumbled into, and I thought that the Dear Abby model was, and I imagine Dear Abby made lots of horrible mistakes in her life, and she didn't speak to her sister, twin sister, for years on end, and all that. In fact, but one of the funniest
her competition, Ann Landers.
Yeah, one of the funniest and best fan letters I ever got at the Times was from Ann Landers' daughter, who herself was a longtime advice columnist, and she said that her mother told her, when anyone ever said to you, "Why you? Why should we listen to your advice?" And she said the answer was always, "Because somebody asked me." And I thought that she was just about right.
Well, how many letters do you normally get each week?
Well,
because this is the New York Times. We don't normally think of the New York Times doing anything like a Dear Abby, but it winds up having two advice columns every Sunday.
It winds up having two. When I started, I thought I would be going for 3.5 years ago. I thought we would be going for 6 weeks because I thought we'd get 25 letters and then we'd be done. At this point, we're getting thousands of letters. Social Cues is getting thousands of letters a month, and you could really use almost any of them. They're so interesting.
Abby and her sister had a kind of Midwestern sensibility. Does writing for the New York Times lead you to come up with more sophisticated answers? Because you've said your column is like Dear Abby, but with a shot of espresso.
Well, I think that people want, in New York, people want us to get to answers faster, and they want us to get to... we're willing maybe to be a little bit edgier than folks might be in Chicago, where this Abby and Epi and laid their claims.
We're going to start taking some questions from our listeners in just a few moments. And by the way, our number here is 646-829-3985. But I want to talk about the holidays, because this is a time of year that's just fraught with potential tension and stress. What makes it such a stressful time for people?
Well, you know, I think we're all such products of, we're all such products of the media right now. And we've seen so many wonderful, corny, horrible specials about how heartwarming and fantastic everything is supposed to be. And I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves. And I also think... So we're putting pressure on ourselves to have our lives be fantastic and communing with our family and dear friends. But, we also get four times as many invitations as we get in an average May, and we're running ourselves ragged. And so we make some poor decisions and don't know how to say no anymore.
Along these lines, one of our listeners writes in on Twitter, I have a phobia about parties. What should I say when I decline invites? I decline 10 to 15 a year.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? I think that is such a statement. I mean, I'm sure there is such a thing as a phobia of a party, but I think it's such an interesting thing of that we're so out of practice being in touch with people now that if you didn't want to go to a party, you know, back before the internet exploded and everybody was doing, you know, we used to sit in each other's offices and talk on the phone endlessly. And so when people asked you to do something and you didn't want to, we knew how to say no. It's like there's a I've got a whole generation of people who don't know how to say no because everything is on text and they're afraid of being rude. But why not simply say, you know, parties are a situation that make me feel uncomfortable. I hope you don't mind if I'm not able to come.
You recommend a catchphrase, ho, 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 or hold, hold, hold.
Yeah. Exactly. I can't. Each of the 20 chapters in the book has a little a gimmick, a party trick, a math exercise, a mnemonic, a something. And for the holidays, it is ho ho ho. It is the first one is hold back. Just don't say yes to everything that crosses your desk, or you will be as tired as Lindsay Lohan at the end of Oscar season. The second one would be hold your tongue, because remember, that guy or woman who is annoying the hell out of you, they're just trying to get through this season too. And the most important one, because I really read horrifying stories in this department, is hold the booze. When you're at the office party, unspeakably bad things can happen when you keep going to that open bar.
And one of the questions in your book is... I drank more than my fair share at my office's Christmas party and vaguely remember stroking the hair of a pretty girl in my department. Now what should I do?
Vaguely remember. Let's just hope his memory is fairly complete, and that's where it is. But, you know, another thing that our digital life has freed us from in a way, and I use free, but I don't think it's a good freedom. It's freed us from that awkward couple of seconds that it can take to make a bad situation good. So to go right up to that woman on Monday morning and say, God,
I hope I didn't cross the line.
God, I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. And I hope you can forgive me for it. Because now we're more, you know, texts and emails give us a chance to be passive about it, but they don't really convey anything like sorrow or, you know, that's why all those annoying emoticons have come to exist, because they don't, texts and emails, they don't have facial expressions, they don't have tones of voice, so we need to import them somehow into this all-text life we're living.
And my big problem with texting or emailing is that you then have to wait for a response, and then it gets really rigid. Whereas if you have a conversation, sometimes you can, you can't make it at 7? Okay, how about 7:30?
Yeah.
And it's done with.
It's very funny that the questions that come into the column as the alpha, and they're alpha-type questions and omega-type questions. The alpha-type questions are people who are so flummoxed by the explosion of our digital worlds, what the mishaps that they run into on Facebook and Twitter and internet dating and what their children are doing in all these places. That's the cutting edge. But then there's also this other edge, the other side of the problem, are people who don't know how to do very basic little things anymore, like invite someone to dinner.
Let's take a call from Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth, on the Upper East Side.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well.
Good. I'm hoping Philip can help me. Try not to be too confusing. I was married for 15 years to a man who lived in the South, and we divorced.
Did you live in the South with him?
Yes, I did. We raised our kids in the South 15 okay. years. They're now in college, out of college,
okay.
three of them. And we do every other year for holidays, which is very common amongst divorced families, as Philip knows. You know, we do Christmas, they do Thanksgiving, blah, blah, blah. This is the first year after 10 years that the new wife, I'll call her, of my ex-husband, although it's been 10 years, has invited us to Thanksgiving. Now, she's dreadful. She meddles. She's always looking for problems. They have two young sons. Now, I have no problems with the ex-husband. In fact, the split was almost amicable. I just, you know, sort of got my way out of there and moved to New York. Anyway, my boys are darling. I'll see them at Christmas. Do I have to drive 4 hours plus to spend Thanksgiving dinner with her 60 relatives just so that the boys can bug out that night to go to the Ravens game?
I don't think you have to. Of course you don't have to. But it actually seems like since this might be a, you know, this might be a really big opportunity because, you know something? The most awful people, even the most awful people, we can usually find something kind of to admire in them. And I kind of admire that after 10 years, she took this first step. And
She's done it before.
But this is kind of like a peace offering, isn't it? Isn't it a way of saying we can move on to another level?
You would think so. But what happens is last time I saw her, she pulled me aside and she said that she thought our 28-year-old son was smoking pot with his friends. Now, I don't know about you, Philip, but, you know, come on.
Listen.
It's not the end of the world, and it's certainly none of her business.
I'm sorry.
And I think you're right. I mean, not all peace offerings. It might be that not all peace offerings are look the way they are, and so fine, so decline. And you have another obligation in New York that's going to keep you here.
Now, talking about first of all, divorces do lead to all sorts of complicated situations like this. But then there are other kinds of problems. Someone has written to us on Twitter, says, how do I handle the presence of my boss's wife and his mistress at company functions? I'm asked to do stuff for both of them.
I think that's so interesting because it requires a lot of someone having played Barnaby Jones, private investigator, unless it's widely known in the office that there's a mistress and a wife. But in my experience, if your job in the office is to help your boss's visitors, then you help them both. I mean, you certainly don't need to get into any discussions about their private arrangements.
Could we talk a bit about gifts at Christmas time?
Yeah.
You had a letter in your book from a woman who realized that a pair of candlesticks that she had been given by her sister was something she had given her sister a couple of years before. And I was thinking about how gifts can carry such a powerful emotion. We feel we're totally misunderstood if we get certain gifts, or we look at a gift and think, you know, I spent $200 on that person last Christmas, this thing couldn't have cost more than $35.
Yeah, it could not be it's one of the biggest weighted subjects, and there's a tit-for-tat quality, then there's the follow-on of thank you notes, and why was my gift not properly appreciated? I'm coming to see that in my life, with the circle of friends and family that I have, that charitable donations are making my life much, much easier. I mean, can you imagine the horror on the face of a woman who unwraps a present that you had given her 2 years before, that she had given you 2 years before?
Well, it does suggest you're not keeping track of things.
Exactly. Or giving it a lot of thought. Yeah.
Philip Galanis is my guest. He's been writing the Social Cues column for the New York Times since 2008, in between working as an entertainment lawyer and writing his own novels.
Yes.
Both published by Knopf.
Yes.
His latest book is published by Simon & Schuster. It's called Social Cues, How to Survive the Quirks, Quandaries, and Quagmires of Today. We will take a little break. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls, read your comments on the air. Our phone number is 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And I'm going to deal with some of the questions that people have written in already. Really complicated problems.
Some of them go to screens and screens and screens. One of the really interesting things about doing this book, Leonard, is that I decided, I mean, this job requires that I answer four a week, but I've gotten thousands of letters as well as commentary. So the way I'd figured out, the way I decided I would figure out what would be my chapters would be to print them all out and go through them and say, where's the volume? Where's the volume coming from? And that's how the book came about. But you can see that some of these emails that people have sent you, they run to thousands of words. And
we've edited them down
to several hundred words.
But you also have to consider which ones are going to apply to a lot of people, as opposed to,
right.
this sounds like a really serious problem, but this is so personal. I'm not sure I want to publish.
And sometimes the Times doesn't really want me. I got a question once from a very young kid, a 13-year-old girl who was from Utah, and she was asking me some really pointed questions that were about sex and about a fear of drugs. And I wanted to answer that question so badly because I get a lot of questions from kids. And the Times did not like the idea of my being in loco parentis. So that's a category of question that I'd love to get into, but just can't.
We'll be back with more right after this. We're back with Philip Galanis. He has compiled some of the questions that he has dealt with in his New York Times column called Social Cues in a book called Social Cues, How to Survive the Quirks, Quandaries, and Quagmires of Today. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And people have been writing in. A lady mentions she notices her man noticing another lady in a public place. Is that should she just shrug it off, or should and what happens if he just denies that it happened, or should he apologize, and what does that all mean?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If she's noticing, and she's noticing enough to write it in an email and send it to you, Leonard, so I'd say it's a problem that she's got to address with the guy. But I don't think it has to be the end of the world. We're all human, and we notice men, and we notice women, and we notice dogs, and we notice children, and to raise it without going to war. I find that so many of the questions that people ask me could be answered with a simply yes, raise it, but do it with a smile on your face, because then they know you're coming in peace, as opposed to we're about to start World War V.
Could you just simply say, you know, it does bother me a little bit when I see you turn to look at some woman's behind as we passed on the street?
Of course. And why would he not? Why would he not? He would understand that. I mean, they're the super defensives. I did no such thing. But if that's her guy, she knows that already. And so she'll have a different strategy.
Judith writes, I have a friend and colleague. We're both teachers. She has suddenly stopped wearing a bra at work. She doesn't have a big bosom, but her clothing really makes it obvious that she isn't wearing one. How can I tell her that I really think her choice is making people uncomfortable without hurting her feelings?
Well, it doesn't seem to be. I mean, unless Judith has taken a straw poll, we really have no idea who it's making. It's certainly making Judith
uncomfortable.
It's certainly making. And when people won't own that in the question, I find it a little troubling. It's making her colleague uncomfortable that she's not wearing a bra. And in my view, whether the colleague is uncomfortable or not is irrelevant. If there were something else that had unfolded, like the colleague said she saw packs of little kids in the playground talking about it, well, that might be something to report on to the teacher.
On the other hand, isn't this really the job of a supervisor?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We have a number of questions related to the workplace. I guess I'm not surprised by that. A listener asks, how do I negotiate extreme tension between my boss and her boss on a daily basis in a small office without taking sides and getting involved?
Yeah, well, she needn't, because it sounds like if I understand the question right, she has a boss, and that boss's boss are the one having the problem. She's an underling to both of them, so she need only be polite, and if she wants to try to bring down the tension in the office place, she can try to keep them moving on separate tracks.
But I've been in that situation where both sides have tried to enlist me. You know, they say, "Oh, do you know what Mary did yesterday?"
So you think that there's a scooping?
Yeah, she
down.
Feels like she is being pulled by both sides, and when you find yourself in the middle, maybe you go with the more powerful boss simply
I think you can always go. You can maybe, and that would be a workplace exception where you would be allowed to talk out of both sides of your mouth and go along with both. Because I think this woman who's writing is junior to both of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So go along with both of them.
A listener from Sunnyside asks, "I work in an office space with a lot of cubicles and not many workers. I still get bothered by a colleague's practice of making a lot of personal phone calls during work. Another colleague also has a habit of self-grooming at his cubicle, something I think is more appropriate as private behavior. Currently, there are so many empty cubicles between the employees that these colleagues aren't a big problem, but we're changing offices soon. How do I ask my boss not to put me in a cubicle next to these colleagues without sounding petty or as though I'm personally attacking them?"
Well, you know, I think when we want something for ourselves, he can simply say, "Listen, this may seem like a strange pet peeve I have, but I really require as much quiet as I can to do my job well. Any chance that when you're assigning the cubicles, you can send me off to no man's land to do it?" I mean, I think that bosses understand that we're all people with individual issues, and there's no shame in admitting it.
Although I don't know why somebody else's telephone calls would bother you. I mean, that's, as long as you don't do it, what's the difference?
Yeah, I guess he's saying the noise of the call bothers him.
My guest is Philip Galanis. His book, Social Cues, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's go to a few of the callers. Jeff from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, Jeff. Go ahead.
I'm calling about sort of a work situation. I know your guest is an entertainment lawyer as well as now a writer at the New York Times. I work with lawyers at a lot of big firms on a certain kind of communication skills, more like presentations. But they often ask me about the awkward situation they find themselves in when they're either at a social event, dinner party, or a professional event, and they're expected to network. Or I have friends who are unemployed and are trying to go to both sort of official networking events, and when they're at a party and they recognize a friend of a friend works in their industry, how to strike up that kind of a networking conversation. The only thing I've ever been able to offer is just try to ask more questions than to talk, but a lot of people are very nervous about that kind of a conversation, and given the economy, I think probably a lot of people are going through that. Right. So I just wondered about your guest's advice in that area.
I'd say go with page 6. Find something kind of funny and juicy on page 6, or Perry's inability to come up with the third department he wanted to cut last night. Lead with something that makes people laugh and makes them feel easy, and before you know it, you're having a conversation. It may it lead to a job, maybe, may it not, of course not, but at least then it's two human beings having a conversation.
Let's take another call. This one is from Edward from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, Edward.
Unusual question. My wife and I are artists and designers, and a friend of ours, who is also an artist, gave us a very large painting of hers, which we loathe. And for a while, we've stashed it in the back of a closet, and when she comes over, if we put it up on the wall, it would displace a good deal of other pieces of our art. What's the diplomatic course?
You know what I... You know where I'm... Well, this is just the way that your story struck me. Why not go back to her and say, "Listen, this piece is, in order for us to hang our collection, this piece is just simply taking up too much of our available wall space. We so appreciate your giving it to us. Is there any way that my wife and I could trade it in for a smaller piece so that it could be part of our larger collection of work? And I think if you did it with a kindness, she might just buy that.
Well, she doesn't do small work, and she is pathologically attached to her work and cannot brook criticism. So,
well, but then you're describing a person who it's virtually impossible to have a relationship with anyway. So I'm not really sure that social cues can be much of the answer here.
There are some people that there's just no way. It doesn't matter what you
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely.
Have you ever gotten a question that shocked you?
I've gotten a number of questions that shocked me. The first one that I got that shocked me, because I've been in a relationship for a long time, so I missed the internet dating revolution. And I would say about 40 or 50% of the questions that I get about internet dating invariably come down to one of them being married, being married and going out on an internet date. So I hadn't understood that internet dating was actually for, you know, when you're bored before the 4 o'clock conference call starts, or, you know, just passing the time. And it really seemed amazing to me that married men, and frankly, it's mostly men. I'm trying to think, did I ever hear a story about a married woman doing this, putting their picture online and taking such a public wager that they wouldn't be caught out. But that shocked me. I don't know why. It shows I'm not very. I don't have a high level of shocking. But I thought that was really shocking.
Even after Anthony Weiner's big scandal, although he didn't put his face on Twitter.
He didn't put his face on the Twitter. That's the truth.
Along those lines, Rachel from New Jersey has written in. I have the worst dilemma. My friend Mike is cheating on his live-in girlfriend with another girl, and it's been going on for 5 years. ! Now he's proposed to the live-in girlfriend, but he's still leading this double life. I'm friends with his live-in, and I want to warn her not to marry him, but Mike was my friend first before his girlfriend. Should I send her an anonymous note?
Oh, I think anonymous notes are about the worst thing that ever happened in the world, because they make people feel as if there's a big brother watching over you. And, oh, don't do an anonymous note. And, you know, it sounds like this soap opera has been playing out fairly painlessly for all involved for a number of years. And I don't know why you need to be the emissary of truth. It seems very unlikely to me that the parties don't at some level already know that there's something of a triad going on. I'd say to keep out of it. The thing that I missed in that was your real attachment to any of the parties.
Let's take another call. This one is from Ariana from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
Me and my boyfriend actually just broke up. We've been dating since June or July, and I was going to meet his mom on the 19th. She's having a 50th birthday party. She's renting out a restaurant, and me and my cousin both RSVP'd to attend, and everything's paid for. Now, he claims that we can be friends, and he still wants me to come, but the reason why I broke up with him is because he's too immature and he's not on the same page as me relationship-wise. I mean, we still care about each other and I would like to be friends with him, but I know that he can't handle that. So I don't really know what to do since everything's already paid for and RSVP'd.
Oh, I think that this is what we'd call a significant intervening event. And I think you are free and absolutely free and clear to write a very sweet note to the mother or the son, whoever sent you the invitation, and say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to make it.
I have a feeling that there were other people who they would have liked to have invited who, for one reason or another, didn't make the cut, and they'll just call them and say, you know, we decided that we found out that we had more space than we thought.
That's an
and
excellent.
We'd love you to come.
That's an excellent point, Leonard. I think that's true in so many social events.
A person has written in on Twitter, how do I deal with my girlfriend's slightly racist parents this Thanksgiving? People often find it, whether it's racist or their politics are so different, and you sit there and you bite your tongue.
You can bite your tongue to a point. You're in somebody else's house and you want to really give them as much respect as you can. But there comes a point when I would say you'd need to speak with your friend and say that this is making you uncomfortable and let her or him deal with the blood relation who is making you uncomfortable. Don't you be the agent of warfare at the Thanksgiving table, because God knows there are enough of them that the friend doesn't need to be the one to put off the grenade.
But what happens when somebody says something particularly offensive to you? Do you just simply let it slide?
No. I take a breath. I really decide whether I have to speak up. And if I have to speak up, I do. And I try to do it as respectfully as I can. Because remember, in this situation, we're a guest in somebody else's home. And it certainly doesn't need to be angry, but you can politely say you really feel uncomfortable by that last thing, and we'd like to change the subject.
Is there a new novel in the works for you?
There is a new novel in the works for me, and it involves an advice giver. So there is a.
It's going to be called Miss Lonely Hearts.
Exactly, and they'll make it into a great movie.
Well, we've been talking about film rights for Social Cues, haven't we? You're an entertainment lawyer.
Exactly.
Social Cues, how to survive the quirks and quandaries and quagmires of today. The columns of Philip Galanis, that appear every week in the Sunday Style section of the New York Times. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's been my great pleasure, Leonard. Thank you for having me. Thank you.